Welcome to the Follow Well Company Ignite Leadership Podcast Series, where we have great conversations with leaders from around the globe. Today, our special guest is Dr. Michael Marvini. Dr. Marvini is one of the division presidents for Apogee Physicians, a private hospitalist company. He's been with Apogee Physicians for 12 years. He started with the company straight out of residency and moved through positions as line-level physician to program director, implementation director, and division president. He brings a fresh perspective for not only managing hospitalist programs, but the integration of those programs into the culture of the hospital. So let's welcome Dr. Michael Marvini. Well, welcome, Dr. Marvini. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I really appreciate this, Rob. My wife and I met about 25 years ago. She was one of my history professors when I was trying to get through college. We spent a few months dating, really got into hiking with each other, hanging out and stuff like that. Got married. We don't have children. We have a dog. My wife is unable to have children, so we were adopting dogs as we were going along in our life. One day, she was asked to do a history of a AIDS clinic. AIDS clinic was the first rural AIDS clinic in Alabama, and she asked if I would go and help volunteer with the with this group. It was the AIDS Services Center in Anniston, Alabama. And this is going to be a very brief into how I got into medicine. But began volunteering there, doing charting and those types of things. The more I hung out with patients, the more I hung out with the doctor, the more I decided this may be something I want to do with my life. So about 2 or 3 years into taking care of and helping at the AIDS clinic, I told my wife I wanted to go to medical school. And I guess her first words were, "I'm sorry, excuse me." Her brother is a physician, and I saw how much he enjoyed taking care of patients. And I started applying to medical school, started taking the prerequisites for school, and got accepted into Pikeville College, which is an osteopathic school in Kentucky. Did my 4 years of medical school there, got into a very small residency program in internal medicine in Easton, Pennsylvania. I was the only American in my residency program and the only osteopathic physician in there as well. Funny story, when I did my interview for the position there, I met the program director, who was a naval captain and a physician and those types of things, when after he retired, he became the director of this program. And he asked me how I would do in a residency program, being the only American, the only DO. And I said, well, I really don't see a difference between osteopathic physicians and medical physicians, or medical doctors, I should say. And he said, well, you know, it's kind of a big difference. I think the learning experience is a little bit different. I said, well, the learning experience gives me the opportunity to understand the human body a little bit better than these guys. And of course, he went into the how do you know that and those types of things. So I explained to him at length about what we do in osteopathic medical schools. And then I told him, I said, well, I think you should accept me. I'm going to be the chief resident in your program. He laughed a little bit and said, well, we've never had a DO chief resident in 50 years of this program being around. I said, well, this is the first time for everything. So once I got into the program, started excelling in my clinical abilities, became the chief resident, was the first one in 50 years there, and finished my chief year out and started a career in hospital medicine. And the reason why I chose hospital medicine was in every single one of my rotations as an outpatient, I didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel comfortable taking care of well people. I felt I needed something different in my life. So fortunately, hospital medicine came around, and that's how I really joined Apogee. As a practicing physician, you know, I started out in Medford, Oregon, seeing 25 patients a day, working 21 days out of the month. And I thought it was a bonanza for me, because I had been used to seeing 30 and 40 patients a day in my residency. This was before the work hour rules had changed and those types of things. So when I got into this job, it was taking care of ICU patients and doing central lines and doing intubations and those types of things. And that's where my career started with Apogee. Once I was in that job for approximately 6 months, I was confronted by my program director, who was going to be moving on to a higher level of administration in Apogee Physicians. And he asked me if I wanted to be the program director, and I, of course, said yes. And he thought I would be very well suited being a chief resident, being able to make schedules and those types of things, and move forward from there. So I was the program director there for about 5 years. And then I was asked to take over a program in Danville, Virginia. This was a program that we'd had for maybe 2 or 3 years, and was in a very difficult hospital, difficult environment, and a difficult place to practice medicine. And I went there as the program director, and was my task was to turn the program around and get the team working as a team, and really taking better care of patients and putting in place some protocols for care and those types of things. I did that for about 2 years, and then was asked to take over as more of a physician leader in the implementation portion of Apogee Physicians. And from that point, my clinical days, taking care of patients actually decreased significantly from that point, because it was a full-time job trying to implement new programs for our company, going in, learning how to set up protocols for different hospitals, meeting the administrations to begin the process of adding in Apogee's thoughts and vision around hospital medicine. From that point, I did that for about 3 years, and then was asked to become one of the division presidents for the company, and that's what I'm doing now. I'm still clinically active in a small town in New Mexico, where I still see patients. We do anywhere from 5 to 7 24-hour shifts, and then I do this job on top of that as well. So my trajectory at Apogee has been a very steep one towards leadership positions and stuff like that, and I really believe that chief resident year helped me move into the more executive part of hospital medicine and medicine itself. And I see myself continuing this. Our company continues to grow, and we continue to add programs in. And I think the most interesting part of my job is really learning how different hospitals operate. You would think that hospitals have a very standardized way of doing things. Apogee has a very standardized way of doing things. However, what we do as a company is when we come into a hospital, we try to figure out, what do you guys do really, really well? What do you do that maybe not doing as well as it could be done? And what do we as a company do really well as Apogee Physicians? And we try to integrate what we do really well with what the hospital does really well, and then build kind of bridges across not only the administration and Apogee, but also with nursing, case management, environmental services, food delivery systems, and those types of things, and try to figure out how do we approach medicine in a different way in hospitals? How do we figure out how to build a healthcare team so that we can all do our jobs better, more efficiently, and make sure that patients are treated safely, effectively, and efficiently? And that's kind of where I've been in my career right now. I don't have a lot of time at home, so my hobbies mainly include my wife, which are hiking and cycling, and we do a lot of snowshoeing. We live up in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, so we get a lot of snow here. So the time that we spend together is very quality time. We each have our own alone time stuff too. So that's kind of a quick intro to me, probably quicker than you would anticipate.
Well, Dr. Marvini, you mentioned that you assimilated a team and that you really engaged that team. How do you go about doing that as a leader? How do you take a team that you've not known before, they've been in place, and you come and assimilate that team into the Apogee team? How do you engage them?
Well, it really starts with a very deep dive into data. I'm an extremely data-driven kind of person. I honestly believe that the only way we can make changes in our lives is be able to measure it first, and then be able to figure out how to make changes. So I spent about 2 months before I took the job in Virginia as the program director of this failing program. And I spent time really looking at the data, trying to find trends in why things were happening the way they were. And what I discovered was that a lot of the physicians that were working there, we had a lot of locum tenens physicians. We didn't have it fully staffed. And the doctors that were Apogee doctors were having to deal with, getting no sign out from locum tenens, or having really poor communication, either from the administration to the hospitalist, because there was no leadership on the ground, or, very poor communication between the nurses, the ED. So the first thing I did was I had a big group meeting. And the group meeting was basically a, hey, get to know Dr. Marvany. I'm coming here to be the program director, but it really wasn't as pleasant as that. I started the talk off with the data that I had collected. I showed them all where they were with their length of stay. I showed them all where they were, you know, with their discharge quotient, which kind of gives me an idea who's discharging, who's not discharging from the program, and their response time to admissions and those types of things. I find that if physicians are confronted with data, they're more likely to make change in their life than they are with anecdotal evidence. And that's kind of how I deal with all of my programs, but I really, really learned how to do that in this program. And once I showed them the data, it was funny because they really wanted to start changing. And in order to make that change, we had to have some protocols put in place. So I actually allowed them to help me build those protocols to make things better in the hospital. I was just showing up. These poor guys have been there for a couple of years and were kind of, you know, wallowing around having an idea of what it should be like. And then somebody comes in and puts a little bit of structure in place. And then I allow them to make that change in the program, provided it was, you know, a proper change. But I think empowering people to make change in their own lives is one of the most important things we do. And I do that with patients as well. When I'm doing my clinical shifts, I try to find out that if there's something that I did in the hospital that was uncomfortable for you or you didn't feel I did well, I always tell the patients, if there's something I did, let me know what it was. And that way, the next person that comes in, I'll make that change for them. So I've done a couple of things. I've allowed the patient to tell me what I did wrong or if there's something I could do better. But not only that, I allow them to empower themselves to empower me to do something better for somebody else. And I do the same thing with the doctors. You know, I give them ideas about what things should look like. And then I ask them, you've been here longer than me. Tell me how you think this process can work. And really getting them involved. And what happened after that was doctors were picking up extra shifts. They wanted to get rid of all the locum tenens. We were seeing 20, 25 patients each until we could get our team hired in. The administration turned around and couldn't believe what was going on. Our length of stay went down. Patient satisfaction started to climb up from the 1th percentile, you know, up into the 14th percentile, which is a gigantic jump. And I think we did that in about 2 months. But it's just empowering people to let them be the best that they can be instead of always criticizing them for what they're not. And I think that's an important thing.
Well, medicine is certainly changing. What do you see as the role of hospitalists going forward?
Well, you're absolutely right. Medicine is changing, and it's changing in a very, very profound way. We know that there's going to be a gigantic physician shortage once the older physicians start retiring. So as a company, what we've seen is that the integration of advanced practice providers, APPs, nurse practitioners, and PAs they will take an integral role in medicine in general. We see this in anesthesiology with CRNAs. We see this in clinics that are run by nurse practitioners and PAs and then overseen by a physician. In hospital medicine, what we're doing is we're integrating them into the daily operations of hospital medicine. We know that at some point we are not going to have enough physicians to fill the spots for what we need. So as a company, we look forward knowing this, and we train our APPs, physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners into the roles that we feel that they're best suited for. We have some of our programs where we have APPs that are seeing 16, 17 patients each. These are nurse practitioners that came from very high level trauma centers who were you know, practicing almost independently in those practices, doing admissions, follow-ups, and stuff like that. And we're using them as our trainers in some of our programs as well, where we're bringing in new nurse practitioners and trying to train them to do what we do, not completely, but to allow them to see patients to the limit of their license, depending on the state and wherever. But I honestly believe that this is going to be a wave of the future. We see new medical schools. We don't see a whole lot of new residency programs opening up to take on more residents. There's certainly not enough physicians going around, especially in primary care. Hospital medicine is considered primary care. We see physicians moving more into some specialty work than we do into hospital medicine or family medicine. So I really honestly believe this is going to be a wave of the future, and we have to be on the front of that wave instead of at the back trying to catch up. And that's where we are right now. And for hospital medicine, we really honestly see hospitalists doing more and more of the admissions in the hospital. We would rather be called from the ER for a hip fracture of an old frail person than be called, you know, 2 days into the service or after surgery when they're having problems. So being the universal admitter, I think, is an extremely important thing that we do as well. So we're admitting for every one of the service lines into the hospital and then consulting the specialist on those patients. So we have a better control over, you know, what happens from day one from the patient being cared for to the last day. And that kind of gets us integrated into the idea of the hospitalist not being the lone ranger in the hospital anymore, but being a part of a healthcare team. So the other trend is the hospitalists really partnering with case management, social work, nursing, physical therapy and occupational therapy by meeting on a daily basis for all the patients on our list and really going over, you know, what is the trajectory of the patient? Where are they going? They came in on day one, they're on day two right now. They're going to need, you know, a hospital bed when they go home or physical therapy, occupational therapy. And we work on that all the way through the hospital stay. So when we discharge the patients home, that's the safest discharge they could possibly have. And I think that's going to be the trend in medicine where we're working better, you know, within groups instead of just being the doctor in the hospital taking care of the patient. Now it's a healthcare team instead of the health, you know, the healthcare individual being the doctor.
Well, Dr. Marvin, you've had a very successful career to date. We all have those times where we did not live up to either our own expectations or we didn't live up to the expectations of others. Can you tell us about a time like that in your life? And how you process that, how you reflected upon it, and then move forward from that.
Yeah, I mean, every person that I know has got some story that they tell you about how there was some failure in what they did, but maybe not really a failure, but a disappointment in themselves. And a few times it happens to me. You know, I teach residents and I teach students, I'm medical students on a regular basis when I'm practicing clinically. And I always try to instill in them, you know, when you know you've done something wrong, the best thing you can do is acknowledge that to yourself, or you didn't, when you didn't live up to your expectations, you acknowledge that to yourself. So one of the ways it happens to me is when I'm trying to negotiate contracts, or I'm trying to negotiate staffing levels and those types of things. And, you know, I feel I know what's absolutely best for whatever the situation is. And a typical example is, you know, we're trying to negotiate a upstaff for a team that's working really, really hard and they're extremely stressed out. And, you know, we're just getting nowhere with the negotiation of trying to get an extra physician in on during the day or an extra APP on during the day. And I strive to bring as much data as possible to these conversations. And I think my biggest failing is that when I present people with data and the data are consistent with, yes, we need to do this, and I can't, and the administrator or whoever we're dealing with, you know, comes back with, well, on Saturdays and Sundays, they're not as busy or something like that. And it's almost like a blow to me, like, oh, you brought all this data and you didn't anticipate what was going to be asked of you in the questioning. I always like to be very prepared for things. And when I'm not prepared for something, it gives me the opportunity, of course, to say, all right, I'm better prepared next time for something, a question like this or an opportunity like this. I've disappointed myself in several ways with the company. I don't feel that sometimes I do a good job of communicating with my team members. I have 147 doctors that work with me on this in my division, and wow. I feel like I don't have enough time to get to them. So what I do on a regular basis is set up phone calls. So I talk to all the program directors. I try to visit all my programs every 3 months. But again, it just doesn't seem like there's enough time in the day. And I think I try to use my time very well, but I know that, you know, I fail some of my doctors by not being, you know, there for them every time that something comes up. And to me, that hurts inside, even though it's something I may not be able to fix. I feel like there's got to be a way that, you know, that I could analyze data a little bit quicker or do something a little bit better in meeting their needs as a team. And so what I do is I travel a lot, as I told you, and I think I'm trying not to travel as much because I think that compensatory mechanism of saying I'm going to get out there, you know, as soon as something goes wrong, I'm just going to fly out there and do that is not as effective as sitting down and having calls with the team and making sure they understand that when I show up, these are the things that I need. So instead of being a knee-jerk reaction of just, oh, I'm going to show up and, you know, I'll be there in 2 minutes, it's better if I can sit back, think about it, analyze it, have calls, and then go visit and have a very structured way of approaching the team or approaching the administration about something that's going wrong. Personally, in my life, when I was young, you know, I hardly finished anything when I was younger. And I spent a lot of time as a youngster getting into karate and never finishing and never getting my black belt or you starting a project and never finishing it. And I saw how that affected me through my life. And what I do now is that I have a very, very structured way of doing projects. If I have to do something at home, like build a fence or something like that, I structure everything around my free time that I want to associate with that project. And then I have a very fixed amount of time, you know, to get a certain amount of it done. So I've added a lot of structure in my life that I didn't have before. And I think, you know, being a chief resident, you have to be on top of everything as the kind of leader of a group of 32 doctors. You know, this was building that structure, you know, really helped me get through this, the leadership position I'm in right now, especially in quick negotiations and quick ideas about how to fix things. So the other thing that I've learned is that the more you do this, the quicker your ideas come to you. So once you build that structure into things, you know, there's a pattern associated with things that we do in this business, especially the business part of it. There's a very set way that things happen. If you don't understand that structure, it's very difficult for you to make changes quickly or be able to think on your feet and make changes quickly. So I guess my failings mainly were the lack of structure in what I did, you know, prior to going into medical school and then becoming chief resident. In residency, you really have to build structure in your life or have to understand the structure in order for you to kind of dive into the executive portion of any business, really. You don't see people starting off the CEOs of company for a very good reason. You know, they have to start out somewhere, understand the structure of that company or that business, and then be able to build upon that. So it's building structure, I think, is what was one of my greatest failings that I've now, you know, had a lot of time to think about and fix, mostly through trial and error.
Well, I think that is so powerful. You know, if you could look back and you had the opportunity to give advice to a younger Dr. Mike Marvini, what advice, or not even as a doctor, but just at any point in your life, what advice would you give yourself, the younger version?
Take time. You got to take time to understand what it is you're talking about, what you're doing. Don't be impulsive. You know, impulsive people tend to not be very good at what they do. They're good at, you know, fixing and putting band-aids on things, but that's all they do. It takes time. You know, a lot of, I think I would tell myself that when somebody asks you a question about something, don't answer immediately. You have to think through these things. And you and I have sat across the table from each other on several occasions. And when asked a question, I try not to have the answer immediately, even though I may have it, but it allows me to think through that answer and put it into the structure of how I want the answer to come out. And that answer has to come out to be, yes, this is something that you and I need to do together. And here's how my side is going to go. And here's how, you know, here are some suggestions about how you can help us get this done as well. So it's being less impulsive in life, spending time to really kind of savor the question, understand what it really means in the big context of things. But I used to be a big fan of, especially in medical school. I mean, the big idea in medical school is somebody asks a question, you better answer right away. And that kind of instills in us this kind of weakness, you know, through our entire careers, because when we're asked a question from a patient, we want the answer immediately. We want to be able to say it immediately. Oh, here's what's wrong with you. Instead of reflecting on what that question really means to the patient, taking the time to think through, how am I going to say this to somebody especially if it's not something that's, you know, pleasurable, like cancer or something like that, how do I answer that question in a way that is supportive and, you know, is well thought out? Because I was an extremely impulsive youngster.
Yeah, I would venture to say that most of us have been that way at some point in our lives. I know that you're a voracious reader. What are some of those books that have had a real impact on you and your leadership style?
Well, I have two favorite books. They're not leadership books or anything like this, and I'm going to tell you what they are, then I'll tell you why I'm impressed with them. The first one is Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, and then The River of Doubt by Candace Millard. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, simply because it's one of the funniest books I've ever read, but it also has a message to it. You know, it's everything's going to be okay. Just take your time, think things through, and, you know, enjoy life. The River of Doubt, probably one of the best books I've ever read. It took me about a day and a half to read it. I never put it down. I just basically read the entire thing through. And it's a journey of Theodore Roosevelt through the Amazon River. And what that book really did for me was to show you what it was like back then. These were people who, you know, were trying to get to the end of this journey and had every trial, tribulation you could possibly think of, but they succeeded. And they didn't succeed because they had technology. They didn't succeed because they, you know, had help from the outside. They were by themselves on the river, carrying canoes, carrying their equipment, getting through this horrible situation. And it really reflects back on this situation we call life. You know, we have our trials and tribulations. We do have support mechanisms, but sometimes those support mechanisms are from the outside, and they really don't, they don't focus on who we are as people. They focus on how you would do something if you were, you know, in a group of people. But this book really, really focuses on, you know, here's a group of guys that went down into a place where no other white people have ever been and just tried to figure out what was down there. And it's just a really good book. Another really good book, and I can't remember the author's name, but it's called Deep Survival. That book takes survival lessons from people who actually survived very horrible, you know, climbing accidents and those types of things all the way through business. And it gives you the idea and kind of a theory about, you know, why do some people do really, really well at stuff? And why do some people just with the same education, the same acumen for whatever that job is, just don't do well? But it starts off with survival from, you know, avalanches and those types of things, and trying to get the mentality of the survivors to kind of get an idea of what did they do different than everybody else? What was their mentality? What was their idea about, you know, survival? And it was just a very interesting book. And I suggest everybody listening here take a read for that book. It's a good one. It's a real good book.
Well, do you have a favorite quote that stands out to you?
I do. And I am passionate about the truth. And author Schopenhauer has a quote about truth that starts off with, "All truth passes through three stages. First, it is ridiculed. Second, it is violently opposed. And third, it is accepted as being self-evident." And I use that quote, and I think about that when I'm negotiating with people and telling them things that they may not believe are real, and then providing evidence. And then it's, of course, opposed. This is no way. There's no way that this is the way this is. And then about 3 months later, it's like, oh, this is exactly the way it was. So that quote is actually at the bottom of every one of the emails I send out, because it helps me realize that if I send an email out and people immediately reject it, or they immediately say that this can't be the way it is, I know that we're going through these three stages. It's almost like grief, but we're going through the three stages of truth. And the more we talk about it, the more we access the data, the more we access, you know, what's really going on, the easier it is to accept as being self-evident.
Sure. I love it. Well, again, you've had a very successful career. What do you see as sort of that next chapter in your life?
Well, I think refining what I do. You know, life is just a never-ending kind of progression of refinement of what you do. The more you learn, the better you become at something. So I'm starting to really get into reading a lot of leadership books and those types of things, especially in healthcare leadership, and integrating some of those things into my life. But the next 10 years, I see myself doing this job, as well as probably developing some business development type things and trying to develop some abilities for our company to do more consulting work with hospitals that may have a failing hospitalist program, that they're not looking for change yet, but looking for some guidance and advice on how to make that change in their own programs, and then maybe make it a little bit sticky with some ability for us to go back on a regular basis, meet with their hospitalists. So I really do want to expand what I do. I really honestly believe our company does a very good job at what it, at hospital medicine and integrating hospital medicine into hospitals. And I think a lot of places that run their own programs, hospitals that run their own programs, just but don't have the bandwidth to be able to sit down with the docs and present them with the data that they need, with the exception of maybe sending them a piece of paper with their HCAP scores and their length of stay and those types of stuff, but not really understanding what that means to them, especially in the big picture, and just, you know, being able to go out and talk to people. I really enjoy sharing what I know about hospital medicine, even if it means we don't get a program. I really enjoy, you know, sharing with administrations and nursing and groups of CEOs about what we do as a company and why it's important to me and how I think we can change things for the better, getting doctors on board, nurses on board, and really integrating hospital medicine into the hospital. I mean, hospital, as Dr. Gregory, our CEO, says, hospitalist, 75% of the word is hospital. We can't ignore the hospital by being hospitalists.
Well, Dr. Marvini, I can't tell you how great it has been to have you on the podcast. Do you have any closing thoughts or leadership lessons that you haven't shared that you'd love to share with our podcast audience?
Sure. Thanks, Rob. I really appreciate being on the podcast as well. I think the biggest thing, you know, being in a leadership position means that people listen to you. They either accept what you have to say, are somewhat skeptical about what you have to say, or completely reject it. And I really honestly believe it goes back to building a partnership with whomever you're the leader of, or the group of people that you're talking to. Physicians are notoriously individual people. They have a very, very hard time integrating themselves into something, you know, more bigger than they are. We're taught in medical school and in residency that, you know, you're the lone ranger. You got to take care of the patient. This is all up to you. I think that's all changing now. And I see a change for the better, especially people coming out of residency today. 5 years ago, when I mentioned IDT rounds or interdisciplinary rounding to people coming out of residency, they basically looked at me like I had a horn sticking out of my head. Now, when I talk about it, they all understand what it is and how important it is. And being able to integrate that into the hospitals, I think, is much easier task now than it was before. But as far as the leadership portion of that is making sure that the residents and the new doctors coming out have the support of the leaders in our company is probably paramount, simply because they haven't had this type of leadership before. They haven't had this type of autonomy before. They have to believe in what we do, and they have to understand that if they ever have an issue or a problem, they pick up the phone, one phone call, and you get a physician leader from our company on the phone with them to help them out. And the same goes with, you know, talking to new hospitals. I think it's extremely important for leaders who are going out into the business world or into a situation where they're talking to somebody for the very first time. Our biggest problem as physicians is we interrupt people. We talk a lot. We talk over people. If you're a leader and you don't listen, you're never going to be a good leader. I sit and listen for minutes at a time, hours at a time, if I have to, before I interject. But I'm thinking through everything that's being said, and that way I can refer back to it, you know, when it's my turn to talk. But leaders, especially in medicine, physician leaders, the most difficult thing for us to do is to relate to non-physician or non-clinician people and try to explain exactly what it is that goes through our minds, because it's certainly different than what a CEO of a hospital or a CFO of a hospital has going through their mind. So it's being able to integrate what, you know, the language of a CEO, the language of a CFO, with the language of a physician. And it's just that inner feeling that if when you walk into a room and you say something wrong, you know it immediately and you never do it again. You kind of do that with leadership as well, because we all learn from our mistakes. We make little mistakes throughout our lives all the time. But being able to sit down, you know, with a stranger and explain, you know, your position on X, and then understand their position, reiterate that back to them so that they know that you understand what they're talking about and the position that they're coming from, and then take that information, integrate it into what you're trying to accomplish, so that it seems like a team effect instead of just you and me working together, you know, to figure out how we fix something. It's bringing the whole idea of hospital administration to fiscal responsibility to physician leadership, and then back to hospital leadership. That whole circle has to be complete and everybody has to be on the same page. And if you're able to bring that together in a hospital, especially in as a physician leader, then you've done your job. Will there be times when people disagree with what, you know, the consensus is? Absolutely. That's why it's a consensus and, you know, not a dictatorship. There are times when I will butt heads with CEOs about things that I understand to be, you know, what we need in a program, and, you know, that directly impacts the cost of a program or, you know, the bottom line of the hospital. So it's the idea of bringing all these people together again, saying, if we do this, I appreciate it's going to be expensive up front, but here are the cost savings, you know, down the line. And then the CFOs get on board, and then the COOs get on board. So being a leader really means you're not pulling people along, or you're not pushing people, you know, into what you believe. You're pulling them along to your ideas. And hopefully some of those ideas are going to be global ideas that everybody can agree on. And then you have that ability to build rapport with people and just kind of get through the whole situation. That, I think, as being a physician, was the most difficult part for me, was learning that. But once you get the idea and once you learn that and get into doing it, it becomes much, much easier, because now you're seeing things from everybody else's point of view as well. And you're pulling them along to your ideas, but integrating theirs as well. So I think that's the key thing about leadership, is if you get into leadership thinking you're going to boss people around, you're getting into leadership for the wrong reason. You know, I tell all of my doctors, you know, nobody works for me. Everyone works with me.
Boy, that is great advice for every one of us. And you are a great leader. And I definitely enjoyed working with you and with Apogee.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So, Dr. Marvini, if there are folks that listen to this podcast who want to learn more about Apogee or want to reach out and talk to you directly, what's the best way to reach you?
To reach Apogee, probably start off with the webpage, which is apogeephysicians.com. You can reach me personally, Michael.Marvini, M-A-R-V-I-N-N-Y, at apogeephysicians.com.
Yeah, I want to thank you for being a part today and sharing with us. So for the Followell Company, this is Rob Followell and the Ignite Leadership Series. We want to thank Dr. Marvini for being a part, and we want to thank everybody for listening today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.